an $8 billion deficit, whoever did this should be going to jail.
Just raise property taxes, tell people you give them back, then don't. Problem solved.
I've got a plan.
Chris Daggett!
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon.
And Ken, who were those people?
Ron Elving and Ken Reardon. Oh, you mean in the ad?
The people
in the open. Well, actually, that was a real ad from Chris Daggett, who's an independent candidate for governor in New Jersey. And he had two actors portraying Chris Christie, the Republican, and John...
Well, actors.
Yes, but it is hysterical to watch.
Extraordinarily bad actors.
And John Corzine, the Democratic...
Well, the actor portraying Chris Daggett may be the worst of the
three. That was Chris Daggett.
I see.
Yeah.
Quick, obvious question. Is this ad effective? Is it going to do Daggett some good?
Well, I don't know. I mean, New Jersey is a very expensive state to run in. Obviously, John Corzine is outspending Chris Christie 3-1. And, of course, Corzine has multi-millions of dollars at his disposal. And New Jersey is very expensive because you have the New York markets
and
the Philadelphia markets.
Anybody in those two cities watching TV these nights?
There's a World Series going on. And it's my understanding that...
How'd that first game go?
My TV wasn't working because I kicked my foot in it when the Yankees were losing.
Only the second time Chase Utley hit a home run off Sabathia.
Did you know that Chase Utley, a lefty, hit two home runs off a left-hand pitcher? This is the first time since Babe Ruth in the World Series. Did you read that?
Happened. Yeah.
It's pretty
it's
remarkable.
Been a lot of historical events in this particular series. So the people from New York and Philadelphia have reason to be watching TV, but mostly they're seeing ads for John Corzine and now this Chris Daggett ad, which probably will give more people a picture of Chris Christie than most of Chris Christie's ads.
Well, that's the problem. If the argument is about what has John Corzine done in the past 4 years, then John Corzine does not get reelected. And so Corzine, realizing this, has decided to make this a referendum on Chris Christie, his opponent. And now most voters say that there's questions about Chris Christie's ethics and honesty and things like that, when for 4 years, that's all they've been talking about with John Corzine.
Now, can Chris Daggett get elected? Has he got the money to put enough points behind this ad, gross ratings points, that he can really get it in front of the eyeballs of New Jersey?
Well, you can make the case that nobody expected Jesse Ventura to win in 1998 in Minnesota.
You're right. Jesse Ventura won in a close three-way race with a couple of stiffs.
One of the stiffs was Norm Coleman, by the way, if you remember that.
And now we know just how stiff Norm is.
Okay, so do I think he has a chance of winning? I don't. Do I think that his numbers are 20% right now with less than a week to go before the election will decrease? I do. The history of third-party candidates always shows at the end, voters say I will not waste a vote. And polls show that most of the people who were supporting Chris Daggett were Christie supporters. So if there's a...
Were they Christie supporters or were they just Corzine opponents? They were people who had no intention of voting for Corzine and they were trying to decide between Christie
and Daggett. Think they were Christie voters who, as Corzine started to portray Christie as a questionable character...
Hammering him.
Exactly. They start to go to Daggett. Now, if they start to leave Daggett, I suspect they do go back to Christie if that's the case. Whether it's enough, there's a new Quinnipiac poll that's out this week that shows Corzine up by 5 points. There's also a Rasmussen poll that shows Christie up by 3 points. So
that's a big swing between two pretty well-known polls. Now, they're done in different ways. Quinnipiac is a more traditional poll. Rasmussen is done by computer. You don't actually get interviewed by a human being, so it's a little different. Some people think it's better. Some people think it's worse. Some people also think the Rasmussen polls are Republican-friendly.
But I think the fact that one poll shows it pretty close with a Corzine lead, one close with a Christie lead, and ultimately it depends what happens to the Daggett voters, and that will decide what happens.
And that's why we're so glad we have you, the political junkie, here with us today. Ken, who's going to win?
I think Bob McDonnell wins in Virginia pretty handily.
Great. Yeah. Okay. Well, we wrapped up the Virginia race, which absolutely nobody has any arguments about. What about New Jersey?
Ken? Well, my gut tells me that if this election were a month ago, we'd be out of a job because why were people voting and we didn't cover it? Right?
Why are we still talking about an election that happened a month ago?
My gut tells me that Corzine pulls it out mostly because he has made the argument not to be reelected, but that Chris Christie is an unacceptable alternative. And I suspect that with all the money that Corzine has at his disposal, the question marks about Christie, which are on the front page of all the newspapers, the fact that the Newark Star-Ledger, the biggest paper in the state, has endorsed Daggett, I think Corzine pulls it out. Ron, do you want to weigh in on that?
I think Cree Deeds has never really been in the race in Virginia, and I think that he will be the loser there.
Yeah. New Jersey?
In New Jersey, I don't really have a way of arguing with you. I just don't think there's any way to predict a race like this. I don't think that there is a secret number out there that if you could exactly poll the state perfectly would reveal the answer. I think people are going to make up their minds in the last couple, 3 days. And it may depend on a story we don't know about yet that's going to surface in the next 3 or 4 days. Oftentimes that happens in the close of these kinds of
races. And New Jersey voters are especially known for deciding at the last minute. The only thing I'm also thinking about is that with the World Series going on, and obviously Northern New Jersey being Yankee fans, Southern New Jersey being Phillies fans, Coors Line will be blanketing those games with commercials that could make a difference.
Superior resources have an opportunity to really matter because everyone's going to be watching television.
But I don't know if that negates the last 4 years, which if you look at Coors Line's record, does not show much improvement in the economy and the way things are being run in New Jersey. Ron, are we finished with Virginia yet? Because
I'm finished with Virginia.
A lot of people are. Bob McDonald, new poll shows McDonald, the Republican, increasing his lead.
Now, the Cree Deeds campaign is dead in the water and has been for weeks. I mean, they couldn't decide whether to run away from Obama or with Obama. And in the end, they had to bring him into the state to help them raise money, to help them get some attention. And that, of course, completely negated any effort he had made to distance himself and have a little arm's length from a president who was only moderately popular in a state that voted for him a year ago.
Does the result in Virginia say anything about Obama? Is there a,
I don't think the
Obama
result
message?
Does. I think the fact that Obama was not a clear positive for Cree Deeds is what you want to know. The fact that Cree Deeds was never helped by Obama and, in fact, probably considered him a net burden. Being associated with Barack Obama at this juncture, a year after he carried Virginia, is not a big positive for a Democratic candidate in Virginia unless he's got some way of turning that energy in his favor. And clearly, Cree Deeds did not. He did not run as a Northern Virginia candidate. He did not run national candidate. He ran as an older-style Virginia candidate. And that doesn't fit with the new Obama notion of politics in any part of the country.
And yet, once upon a time, going back to the famous 1989 thesis about women and working women and their role in society, that Bob McDonald said, to his dismay and to the campaign's dismay, you thought that that would be a
it was
a,
it was
a,
and
an
he
issue
went,
handed
he,
to the
and
Democrats.
He ran with it and he closed the gap. And then,
well, he had nothing else to say is what the problem was.
And in the end, people were willing to say, Bob McDonald has shown enough indication that those are not his current feelings towards women. It doesn't appear that the man is still carrying with him the opinions that he had 20 years ago.
Polls show that women actually favor McDonald over Deeds, and as independents are way big for McDonald over Deeds.
What about New York 23? Does the White House have a role to play there?
Actually, I think the White House is the least interesting part of this whole thing. It's about the future of the Republican Party. I suspect that when the Republican leaders up in New York 23, upstate New York, picked Dee Dee Scozzafava, the longtime state assemblywoman, as their Republican candidate, they thought this was the person who would keep the seat.
Because she's a Republican moderate to liberal figure in a part of the state that's trending in that direction, but still historically Republican.
Historically, not since there's been a Republican Party has a Democrat won that seat. However, this is the one that John McHugh left to become Army Secretary. But she is very liberal on choice, on gay rights, on some taxes, on the Obama stimulus package. And conservatives, small C conservatives, say this is unacceptable. And they're backing a capital C conservative, Doug Hoffman, who is getting endorsements not only from Club for Growth types, but from Sarah Palin, from Tim Pawlenty.
Tim Pawlenty was a surprise to me.
Yes.
I mean, you would expect Sarah Palin to be sort of, you know, going rogue in her own style and doing the insurgent Republican role in this particular race. But Tim Pawlenty was supposed to be a guy who was going to be looking for the more moderate lane in the Republican Party. To have him running against a nominated Republican Party official candidate, that sends a real signal.
Interestingly, the only Republicans I could see nationally who've endorsed
Newt Gingrich.
Well, of course, Michael Steele, who's the chairman of the RNC.
Well,
but
he's really obligated.
But Newt Gingrich and all the conservative blogs are now calling him a sellout, an establishment figure.
I think Newt made a bad call here. I think he thought he was getting in on something that would be a good signal for his particular
big
constituency.
Tent Republicans.
But that he's beginning to sound a little bit like maybe last decade, maybe the 1994 kind of Republican insurgent.
Even Mitt Romney made a point of saying, I cannot endorse the Republican candidate. Of course, he has not endorsed a conservative either. But even Mitt Romney's afraid to stand up to what seems to be a conservative onslaught in the New York 23rd.
One other wrinkle going on here, what appears to be a little bit of overexuberance on the part of one of Doug Hoffman's supporters who comes from the state of Arkansas, a little bit outside the district, and who has actually put some money into the race, but not in a straight-up way by endorsing Doug Hoffman and putting on ads in favor of Doug Hoffman, but how?
There's an ad going up on New York 23, ostensibly by the Common Sense in America LLP organization.
On Tuesday, progressives have one candidate to vote for with pride, Didi Scotafava. Didi supports President Obama's efforts to stimulate our economy.
As it turns out, the head of Common Sense in America is a guy named Jackson Stevens, a longtime board member of the Club for Growth, who has given money to Doug Hoffman, who has supported conservative candidates and causes in the past. And this is, in my view...
It's a torpedo job.
It's a clear, dirty trick. This is somebody who's pretending to be a pro-Scozafava supporter, putting up this ad, when ultimately it's sending a message to Republicans saying, Scozafava's a liberal. If you're a true Republican, you should be backing Doug Hoffman, the conservative.
All right, it almost seems like an afterthought at this point, but is there a Democrat in this race?
And it's the Democrat I still think is going to win, even though there's a new poll that shows even the conservative Doug Hoffman, the more Scozafava falls apart, Hoffman has a chance. I still think the Democrat Bill Owens, who, by the way, is a registered independent, is going to... Yes, exactly. That's how much the Democrats... that's where the Democrats are going.
It's probably part of his strength is that he is, in fact, an independent.
He's kind of a conservative on some things. He's against gay marriage. He won't commit to the public option, things like that. But look, President Obama's raised money for him. The Democratic Party seems to be pretty united behind him while the Republicans are fighting among themselves. If you want to talk about headlines coming out on Wednesday, one of the headlines will be, in my view, the Republican Party has lost, once again lost, a historically Republican seat.
That will be one of the headlines. But another way of looking at what goes on Tuesday will be whether or not the third-party candidate in New Jersey, the third-party candidate in New York, effect a kind of frustration for the Republican Party when they clearly have an advantage over the Democratic Party if they were united.
So who do you say wins in New York 23?
I think in New York 23, I still think Owens is going to win because I think that he has enough of a base. There was enough of a vote for Obama in that district.
He carried it.
In 2008, that they can hold that together and win with some plurality. It's obviously going to be a plurality race. Also, one congressional seat being filled in the Bay Area in California. That is, if everyone can get home from work across the Bay Bridge and back to the California 10th District and vote for someone there. And we assume that will be John Garamendi.
Right. This is the seat that Ellen Tauscher gave up to take a job with the State Department. The reason this is not getting the same kind of attention as New York 23 is that it's a solidly Democratic district. Ellen Tauscher has won big since winning the seat in 1996. It has an 18-point Democratic advantage in voter registration. And John Garamendi, who is the current lieutenant governor, who has run statewide six times, losing more than winning.
The times he has won have been lieutenant governor and
state insurance commissioner. Right.
So he has been denied the larger prizes, such as governor, which he was hoping for back in 1994, when he lost to Kathleen Brown.
Right, and also 1982, when he lost to Tom Bradley. He's run for governor several times. He ran for state controller once, also lost that primary, too. It almost reminds me, in a little bizarre way, of Roland Burris in Illinois, the lesser statewide offices. He's been able to win, but the big prize, like governor, he was never able to accomplish. Anyway, but this is still a solidly Democratic district. Garamendi dropped out of the gubernatorial race this year to run for Congress with a vacancy. David Harmer is a conservative first-time candidate who's a Republican. His father was lieutenant governor briefly under Ronald Reagan in the 1970s. He's not a bad candidate, but in that district, no shot.
Not exactly a fair fight. Okay, so we've got a couple of governors. We've got a couple of congressional seats. We also have several mayors, many mayors around the country, but a couple of them particularly interesting. New York, I'm sure that's a tremendous nail-biter there for Mike Bloomberg. I mean, are we sure Mike Bloomberg can pull this out?
Well, what's remarkable is that, and there was a New York Times article in the past week that said that he spent more than any other candidate in history of his own money to help himself get elected.
Even though he doesn't really have any trouble being reelected other than the issue of a third term.
That's exactly right. I mean, the fact that the way that he bullied the city council into getting rid of term limits just for this one time so he can run a third time because he's so indispensable is one thing. But he spent $85 million to beat Bill Thompson, the city controller, for a third term this year. And it's almost obscene. Not that that's so much money, but why? He has strong approval ratings. He's thought to have done a good job. He's likely going to win big. And yet every time he's on the air, he's trashing Bill Thompson. It seems a little bit much overkill.
Can I throw out a theory?
Yes.
He wants to make sure his numbers are as high as possible because he has his eye on another ambition beyond being mayor of New York.
City council president? No, I don't think so. You're thinking about president?
I'm thinking about something. And president is certainly one possibility, given the fact that, as we've been talking about in the polls, people don't like Republicans. They don't like Democrats. They consider themselves independents. They're looking for third options.
He is an independent.
I would say at least as well-heeled as Ross Perot when Ross Perot self-financed a presidential election. Why, back in 1992, Ross Perot ran nationally for $60 million. So here's a guy who's willing to spend $85 million on a local office. Look, he doesn't have to run in Iowa. New Hampshire. All he has to do is get on the ballot in 50 states, and he could run as an independent candidate in 2012, in 2016, but he doesn't want to go out a weakly reelected mayor.
That seems to make sense because there were indications in the middle of his second term that Mike Bloomberg was looking at the White House. He was looking at ways that he could perhaps run as an independent.
Traveling around in California, 2008, right. Advertising himself around.
That stuff on guns, things like that. But the problem is New York has declined in much of his second term. The infrastructure has declined. The taxes have been raised. Unemployment is up. Crime is up. And the record is less laudable and defensible in 2009 than it was in 2005. So I suspect unless things get really bad for the two parties, Bloomberg's rose has dimmed for a future presidential race.
Yeah, I never count out a guy who gets the kind of attention that he gets in New York City. He will always be a media possibility. What about in the city of Atlanta?
Well, not that people are paying too much close attention to this race, but what's interesting to me is that since Maynard Jackson was elected mayor of Atlanta
40 years ago,
1969, very good, there's been a succession of African-American mayors. Andrew Young was mayor. Shirley Franklin is a current mayor. But there is a city councilwoman, a white, fiscally conservative city councilwoman by the name of Mary Norwood, who could very well win the race outright.
Get over 50%.
And among the other cities that are holding mayoral elections on Tuesday is Boston. Thomas Menino, seeking a fifth term in Boston, the longest-serving mayor in Boston history, likely to win a fifth term.
Also going on in Massachusetts at the same time, really getting a lot more attention, is a vote that's not coming until December, when they will have a special election to choose the Democratic and Republican candidates to seek the seat of the recently deceased Teddy Kennedy.
The Democrats had a debate last Monday. The four Democrats, for all the talk about all these candidates who are getting the race, there are only two big-name candidates. The front-runner of the race is State Attorney General Martha Coakley. She's the only woman in the race. She's run statewide, the only candidate to run statewide, has the best name ID. Also, Michael Capuano was the only member of Congress who's challenging her as well. There were two other candidates in the race, Alan Casey, who is a very smart, very liberal, very long-winded. He co-founded the City Year, which is a national service program, and Stephen Pagliuca, who is the co-owner of the Boston Celtics. So there are four candidates in there. The debate was on Monday. I don't think anything changed. But there was something interesting, I thought, that some people have called Martha Coakley's Sarah Palin moment. And that is when she was asked in a radio interview about her international experience. And she says, well, I have a sister who lives overseas. She used to live in London. Now she lives in the Middle East. And that was her answer. And people will say, oh, my goodness, what a gaffe that is.
I can see my sister from my porch.
Exactly right. The question, of course, is whether it has damaged her standing. The primary election is on December 8th. She still has a big lead, a sizable lead. I'm not sure if that many people are paying attention to it. I'm not sure if that many people are saying this could be the beginning of the end for her, because there are still three other candidates in the race. But
dividing the vote that is not hers and pretty much providing her with an insurance policy.
Right. And so we have 5-6 weeks to go before the December 8th primary. She still has the lead, but it's too early.
She needs to make another mistake before that's really going to hurt her. And we should also tell the listener that Paul Kirk, who is currently holding the seat as the appointed successor to Teddy Kennedy, is not a candidate.
That's
he
correct.
Is not seeking to hold the seat
71
permanently.
71 years old, yeah.
And there will be an actual election for the seat following the primary in January.
January 19th, and the Republican candidate will be, by all expectations, State Senator Scott Brown.
Not a household name.
No, and again, there are only 7 or 8 Republicans left in the state of Massachusetts.
And they are not really necessarily known to each other.
No, and that includes Scott Brown, and I suspect that whoever wins the Democratic primary will be the next senator from Massachusetts.
Are there any other elections being held anywhere in America this coming week that we haven't talked about?
Yes, there is an anti-same-sex marriage referendum on the Maine ballot that is getting a lot of national attention.
That would essentially repeal the law they currently have in Maine that allows gays to marry.
That's correct.
And back here in Washington, number of things hopping. We have the end of the recession. Ken, congratulations. You survived another recession.
Yes, but if the Yankees keep losing, then it'll be a depression.
Let me just say that anyone who thinks the recession is over is an economist.
Or he or she is employed. Because if you're not employed, the recession is not over.
Yeah, I think Obama probably is going to treat this news that the recession is, quote, over, about the way he treated the news that he had won the Nobel Prize. Great thing. You want it to happen. You can't say it, you're against it. But this could do him more harm than good in terms of the expectations that it creates, the pressure it creates. And really, to go out there crowing about it looks bad. And speaking of going out there crowing about it, how about that Joe Lieberman? He has found another opportunity to capture the imagination of America.
Well, you're focusing more on Joe Lieberman, and I'd focus more on Harry Reid, because what's fascinating about the public option in the health care overhaul bill—
Can you mean the consumer option?
The consumer option, exactly.
Nancy Pelosi has told us we shouldn't call it the public option. We should call it the consumer option.
Good.
And this program is coming to you from National Consumer Radio.
Like the 2000 election, when we thought Gore had won, and then we thought that Bush had won, and then we thought Gore had won, and then we didn't know anything until the 37 days later in Florida, we thought the public option was dead when the Senate Finance Bill came out with no public option in the bill. Then suddenly it was live again when Harry Reid said the public option will be included. But it seems like Harry Reid forgot to ask his 60-member caucus, including the two independents, how they feel about this.
You know, wait a minute. You know perfectly well that they're polling these people constantly. Their staffs are talking. It isn't a lack of information. So what's Harry Reid really up to?
I don't know the answer, though, to that. Maybe solidarity with Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats in the House, but maybe put pressure on these wavering moderates that, look, it's a done deal. You might as well get on board because the train is leaving the station.
I think on the untold story here is the pressure he's getting from the other direction. I don't think it's Nancy Pelosi that he's worried about. He knows he has to go to conference with the House at some point or another, but he's trying to get a bill through the Senate,
right.
And he's had Jay Rockefeller, whom he respects, and a lot of other people on that side of the Democratic caucus, Roland Burris, saying, I'm not voting for anything that doesn't have public option. Now, Burris doesn't get a lot of respect in Washington right now, but that is another vote they need, every bit as much as they need
every
Joe Lieberman.
Every of the 60 gets respect, right?
Exactly. So Harry Reid, at this particular juncture, felt the ball had to go back over the net to the public option side one more time. And so he puts it in with this states may opt out provision to test whether or not that state opt out provision would be enough to somehow magically grease the deal.
And do we think that that protects the Democratic moderates, like the Blanche Lincolns who were up in 2010, like the Blue Dog Democrats who were up in the House in 2010?
It could if they have the option for their state to opt out before anything becomes effective. If they can't opt out until after the public option is already part of national law, then no, then that's not going to win them over. But if they somehow had the opportunity to wash their hands of it before it ever happened, so that the state of Arkansas, in Blanche Lincoln's case, or whichever state, had a chance to take themselves out of the mix, conceivably, that would be something that he could get to 60 on.
And if many states do opt out of this program, do the progressives come back and say this is a watered-down, weak bill that's perhaps worse than what we have now?
That's the nature of compromise. You try to find something that, while it displeases everybody, it doesn't run anyone completely out of the room. And right now, the problem he has is he's got the Rockefellers and the Burrises saying, we're out of there unless there's something in there we can say to our constituencies is what we want. And you've got the rest of those folks.
The Bys, the Nelsons.
Right, that's right. And they're more numerous, no question. The more moderate Democrats saying, we're not on board for anything that has public option on it. And so along comes Nancy Pelosi and says, well, let's just not call it a public option anymore. That makes people think it's taxpayer financed, which it isn't. So let's call it the consumer option and make it look like an add-on special extra plus for you because you're a good American citizen.
Well, here's another word that it could be called. What about reconciliation?
Oh, God, you know, that is the kind of word that just gets me. When I hear reconciliation, I just want to vote for it. Can I vote for it twice?
Let's explain what that is. Reconciliation would be the process by which the Democrats pass the bill. Ron's making a face because I'm quoting one of the CQ columns. No, but the point is the Democrats could take a very risky move and decide to say that the magic number is not 60, it'll be 51. And if they do that, I mean, not that there's any comity, not comedy, but comity in the Senate anyway, but I suspect that the Senate would shut down for the next 2 years if they decide that it's only 51 votes needed to pass this.
And there are a number of other pieces of legislation that the administration and the Democratic majority badly want to consider. Financial re-regulation.
Clean air.
What you're going to do about Wall Street. Right. The eventual fight that's going to have to be joined over foreign policy with respect to Afghanistan, with respect to Iraq.
Try getting a Republican vote on behalf of anything that President Obama pushes through if they fight for reconciliation on the health care bill.
But let me just ask, what are the chances of a Republican vote anyway? Is this not the downside of the strategy the Republicans have adopted in 2009 of giving absolutely no votes to anything the Democrats want to do? They have, in a sense, already gone nuclear. They have already gone to the mattresses. And why should the Democrats try to accommodate them when there's no indication they're ever going to get any Republican votes for anything?
Well, actually, that's not the case with foreign policy stuff, where I assume if the Obama administration ever decides to announce a coherent policy on Afghanistan, they will need Republican support. And in that case, I suspect they'll get it.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from National Consumer Radio.
Oh, I get it. You're saying, wait, I don't get it.